Okay, it's kind of embarrassing how bad I am at budgeting.
Let me see your charges.
Fine.
You spent over $600 on takeout last month.
I can't cook. You know this.
Yes, I have had your disgusting food, but you're literally paying for a meal subscription on top of that.
Whoa, wait. That can't be right.
Look, just get Rocket Money. It shows you all of your expenses in one place and even tracks your subscriptions. And if there's a subscription you don't want, which for you, there are a lot you don't need, you can just cancel right in the app with a few taps.
So you mean I don't have to call anyone to cancel?
Nope. No hold times or anything. And they'll even try to get you a refund on some of the months of wasted money, which is a lot of money for you.
Okay.
And if you thought I was done, I'm not. The app can also help you make a budget that works for your income. Anytime you get close to your spending limits, it alerts you, so you know exactly where your money is going at all times.
All right, I'm in. What do I have to do?
Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple or Google Play stores.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey all, welcome to How to Fix It. I'm John Avlon, author, historian, journalist, recent congressional candidate. And the purpose of this podcast is to focus on finding solutions to the problems we face, not just endlessly fixating on the problems themselves. Well, one of the best ways to look for solutions is to talk to someone who's a practitioner of politics, as well as a thinker, and in this case, also an author. Steve Israel, former congressman from Long Island's North Shore, representing what had been the 3rd District, now held by Tom Suozzi. And Steve is a great author. He's the owner of a bookstore called Theodore's Books. If you're ever in Oyster Bay doing a Teddy Roosevelt pilgrimage, drop by. But he's the author of many books, including a brand new one called The Einstein Conspiracy. It's just out. It is an excellent piece of historical fiction. It is a thriller. It moves briskly and involves, you know, everything from Albert Einstein on the North Fork of Long Island, writing his prescription, to FDR, to Nazis on Long Island and Yaphank. It's really just loaded with great information, and it's a hell of a lot of fun. Steve Israel, it's good to see you, my friend.
John, what a pleasure it is to be with you. Thanks so much for having me on.
No, listen, I really enjoy this book, and I've enjoyed all your books, and I will say for the record that the rarest of things is a politician who can actually write these days, and you can. Let's start with the book, because it is brisk, it is fun, it is smart. You know, books have seeds that they kind of come into your head, and then they develop into the finished product. What was the seed of the idea that brought you to this book, The Einstein Conspiracy?
Well, first, I do want to acknowledge the fact that you've got some amazing books that have inspired me, and you and I are very much aligned to these moments in history that could have gone the other way. You did Washington's Farewell, Lincoln's Fight for Peace, and I think you did an extraordinary job of finding this one moment, you know, that these personalities who happen to be at a certain place at a certain time and tipped history in the right direction when it could have gone in the wrong direction. For me, that tipping point came when I was traveling in the district that you ran for Congress in, New York 1. I was driving and I came upon this little cottage in Nassau Point overlooking the harbor. And I had been told that that's where Albert Einstein actually wrote a letter to Franklin Delano Roosevelt warning him that Adolf Hitler had an atomic bomb program. They were researching. They were getting close to a bomb. And Einstein wrote this letter, famously called the Einstein-Szilard letter, and said to FDR, Hitler cannot get a bomb before we do, and we have no research program, start one. And I wondered, what if that letter hadn't been written in that little cottage that's still there? What if the scientist Szilard had not driven out to the North Fork of Long Island on a warm day in July and said to Einstein, we must warn Roosevelt. What if Roosevelt had gotten the letter and said, we'll never have an atom bomb? And so that was a tipping point, literally sitting on that road, looking at that cottage and beginning to use my imagination.
And you really do bring it alive, and it's all real, but some of the the great drama of history can best be captured in a work of fiction. And yet there's a lot that's real here.
Yes.
I mentioned Yap Hank. That had been a Nazi summer camp. There's a Nazi rally in Madison Square Garden that I wrote about in Washington's farewell address because it's, you know, they had a big poster of Washington beneath them, a banner. That speaks to, I think, the beauty and really compelling complexity of Long Island. Yeah. Tell people about that.
Well, first of all, there. This is a spy thriller, but it's based on actual events. And so we know that Einstein was composing that letter. We also know that the Nazis had tried to kill Einstein on many different occasions. They tried to kill him in France, in Belgium, in England, and he comes to America where he thinks he's finally safe. We know that he wasn't safe. He arrived. I mean, the book opens up with his arrival in America. I mean, he's not thrilled to be in America. He misses, you know, the charm, the character of Europe, and now he's in this kind of this new modern country. But he thinks he's safe. Well, we also know that Nazism was spreading virulently in New York, that there was a rally in Madison Square Garden, which you wrote about, that attracted 20,000 people in February of 1939, chanting Sieg Heil, Sieg Heil. That magnificent banner of George Washington, flanked by swastika flags. And then there's this little community in Yaphank that also was in the district there that you ran for Congress in, and maybe you will run for Congress again in that district. And this is a community that is originally called German Gardens. The streets are named after Adolf Hitler, Goebbels, Goring. I didn't make that up. That's what the streets were called. They had these massive swastikas and these stormtrooper rallies. Now, this to me was the most chilling aspect of my research. I had heard about it. I just thought it was a bunch of lunatics living in a little community. So popular was the Nazi Camp Siegfried that the Long Island Railroad ran a special train on weekends called the Camp Siegfried Special. And so I wanted to put all this together. This is not a political book. But I did want Americans to understand how dark and ugly it was and how prevalent it was at another time. And when we see swastikas appearing today, those are our flashbacks to what we saw in 1939.
It's a reminder that, I mean, you know, as Mark Twain is said to have uttered, you know, history doesn't repeat, but sometimes it rhymes. And there are these pivotal moments. And this book is set in 1939. It's organized chronologically. And you see how it could have gone the other way. I wonder, having written this book and delved deep into the heart of Camp Siegfried and looked at that appeal of Nazism, which was spreading before the Second World War came to our shores with the attack on Pearl Harbor, what it says to you about that facet of the American character that is, it's not an American problem, it's a human nature problem, susceptible to those sorts of appeals, not just anti-Semitism, but fascism.
Well, look, Americans have always been susceptible to that ugliness. And sometimes it's driven by pure hate. Sometimes it's driven by socioeconomic pressure. Sometimes it's driven by culture. There are a lot of drivers of that. But we've always managed. We've always been able to contain it and move on. What's different now, I fear, is that there's a greater license to go in that direction, a greater license to go back to the days where swastikas are displayed openly, where somebody wears a T-shirt to a supposed rally on January 6th that says Camp Auschwitz, where the left at so many college protests, you know, invoke the Holocaust in a completely inappropriate, and in my view, well, let's just say inappropriate way. So what concerns me is that we're now in this environment where you can say almost anything you want, no matter how ugly it is, and there's just a greater acceptance of that rather than democratic norms and the norms of elevated discourse that should lead us to a better conversation.
Well, I think that's right. And I think the other thing your book reminds us, even though it is a work of fiction, is that individuals have agency. There's a particular responsibility at these tipping points for people to step up. And, I, you know, and Einstein's a pacifist. And yet is compelled to confront the evil of Nazism, yeah, ultimately write this letter. You've got great agents, by the way, agents Amos and Weiss, great yes, characters. I assume those are made up out of whole cloth, but very compelling.
Mm-hmm. No, oh, really? Actually, yeah. So as a history buff, I know you'll appreciate this. And as a Theodore Roosevelt expert, you're going to love this. So there are two FBI agents in the novel, and they are hunting for a Nazi agent who is presumed to be in pursuit of Albert Einstein. And first of all, they feel, well, this shouldn't be too hard to find a Nazi agent on Long Island, until they see Camp Siegfried and a Madison Square Garden rally with 20,000 Nazis. Man, now it's like needle in a haystack. James Amos is based on a real character. John, you've been to Sagamore Hill, right?
Many times. Yeah.
Yes. And so the last thing you heard on the tour of Sagamore Hill, when they bring you to Theodore Roosevelt's bedroom, is they say, whether it's the docent or the park ranger, this is the room that Theodore Roosevelt died in. And his last words were, James, when you turn out the light. And one day I said, well, who's James? And they said, oh, that would be James Amos, who was Theodore Roosevelt's, quote, manservant. Well, I went down a little research rabbit hole. He started out as the caretaker to Roosevelt's children in the White House. Then he becomes Roosevelt's manservant, valet.
Valet, yeah.
Yeah, he's an African-American, but he's called the manservant, right? He becomes Roosevelt's confidant and bodyguard. He's with Roosevelt on the night that he dies. Roosevelt chooses only one human being to be with him when he knows he's in his last hours, and it's James Amos. And what I learned was James Amos becomes the second African-American to become a special agent in Hoover's FBI.
See, and he brings that's what down I didn't a, know. That's fascinating.
He brings down a Nazi spy ring. He goes after the mob. He goes after Murderer, Inc., the Jewish mob. And he dies in obscurity in 1954. And I just wanted to bring that guy to life.
So I knew that James Amos was the manservant's name, and I thought you took license. I didn't know, and I've done a lot on the Milwaukee assassination, which is sort of the recurring yes, flashback he has. But I didn't realize that he had served as bodyguard as well as valet and then went on to the subsequent history in the FBI. Right. That makes it even better.
Yes. And I just loved his character. I had to pay an inordinate amount of money to purchase the last copy on earth, I believe, of James Amos's autobiography from a book dealer in Australia. And the title of his autobiography is A Hero to His Valet, about Roosevelt. Roosevelt was a hero to me, his valet. And he talks about that final night with Roosevelt.
I'm coming over to borrow that book, or at least to sit and check it out. How to Fix It is sponsored by Aura Frames. Now, I've been one to get really behind on holiday shopping. Not a shock. It's a little bit better now. But if you're in a jam, then let me tell you, people all over the bulwark love them some Aura Frames. Now, this is a digital picture frame. You can upload all your favorite photos and upload to your loved one frames remotely. Do it with my folks. And it's perfect with faraway relatives. You can upload unlimited photos and videos to your frame. Just download the Aura app and connect to Wi-Fi. It's easy. You can even preload photos before it ships. Keep adding from anywhere, anytime. And you can share photos and videos effortlessly, straight from your phone all year long. Now, for a limited time, save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $35 off Aura's best-selling Carver Mat Frames, which was named number one by Wirecutter. You can do that by using promo code FIXIT, all caps, at checkout. That's AuraFrames.com, promo code FIXIT. This deal is exclusive to our listeners, and frames, they sell out fast in the holidays. So order ones now, yours now, and get it in time for the big shindig. Support the show by mentioning us at checkout. Thank you. This book would make a phenomenal movie. And it is paced that way. And maybe that was your intention in the back of your mind. But it really is historical fiction in thriller version at its best, to my mind. Now, I had a lot of fun with all the Long Island Easter eggs throughout the book. I mean, there are a ton. I mean, there's Officer Krupski, which is a prominent political figure on the North Fork. There was a Crowley reference. I don't know if that was to your former congressional colleague, yes. Joseph Crowley. But
you're very
all
astute, Avalon. Yes.
Well, this may be appreciation circle of limited numbers, but it really evokes the beauty and the mystery and the history and the drama of that time and Long Island, of course, Albert Einstein. What are your favorite works of historical fiction?
Of historic fiction?
Yeah. The stuff you might have read for inspiration.
I have to say, I love reading any Civil War historic fiction. One of my inspirations is a former colleague, former Congressman Bob Mrazek, wrote a book called Stonewall's Gold, a Civil War fiction that I think is one of the best Civil War fictions I've ever read, other than Red Badge of Courage. I'm also a huge fan of historic nonfiction. Anything Eric Larson writes, I just consume immediately. And, you know, he lives in Southampton, so I've had the opportunity to have dinner with him on many occasions and learn from the best. And then, you know, I'm not blowing smoke here, but I love The Washington's Farewell, love Lincoln's Fight for Peace, and looking forward to the next one.
Well, on Teddy Roosevelt, it's on the Man in the Arena speech, as you know, and we've actually just decided on a new title, Theodore Roosevelt's Guide to Life.
Oh, how great. Love it.
But so I'm hip deep in that right now. So you left Congress, an enormously successful and influential career in Congress, head of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee on two occasions, played major roles in pivotal events. And I want to get there and apply those lessons to the current day. But you left to run the Cornell Institute of Politics, but also to start your own small bookstore. Yeah. Everybody shop your local independent bookstore. Yeah. Theodore's books, it couldn't be more important. Bookstores are the soul of their community. And I remember reading an op-ed years ago by George McGovern, who'd been the 1972 nominee for president by Democrats in a 49-state loss to Richard Nixon. And he, in his post-political career, opened up a bed and breakfast. And he wrote a fascinating op-ed about being a small business owner and how it changed some of his perspectives on liberal or democratic policy priorities, you know, where perhaps there had been an overregulation burdening small businesses with regulation that just wasn't appropriate to the size of them. I wonder, in running a small business, if that's changed your perspective on any policies in particular, or made you feel that there are new policies that need to be engaged.
By all means. It confronts me frequently. You know, when I was in Congress, when we wanted to create a new program or make a new investment, we would just print money. Guess what? You can't do that in a bookstore. You got to pay the publishers. You've got to pay to have books shift. And so literally, we used to talk about pay go all the time, you know, pay as you go as this kind of abstract budgetary policy theory. Well, I'm my own pay go. I literally pay my expenses as I go based on how much money is coming in. Having to wait an inordinately long amount of time for a permit to open and being told at various steps, even though you complied with what we told you last time, we have a new regulation this time, made me a little bit, I believe in regulation. I believe that we need rules that keep people safe. Rules of the road. But sometimes the process overtakes the outcome. I think we need to do a better job. And frankly, I think my party needs to do a better job of communicating policies and advocating for policies where it's not the process that matters as much as a good outcome, whether you're a small business helping to expand jobs in your community or a larger enterprise.
And I think, you know, this is something we talked about a little bit in the context of my campaign, is that I was very focused on how Democrats can get back on the side of small business. Because it's all about rebuilding the middle of our politics, middle of our economy. But really, small businesses end up getting burdened with a lot of the regulation and accounting and other things that are entirely appropriate for a big business that may be able to afford a phalanx of lawyers and accountants and staff. But for a small business, it's just suffocating. I wonder, you know, to the extent you've thought about policy solutions for that space, what's a Democratic agenda for helping small business look like?
I think we need to be more supportive of risk by small businesses, of entrepreneurship by small businesses. I'll give you a very, very specific example. We have tried on many occasions as a small business, as a local bookstore that's hoping to keep our community afloat, to get on various bidding lists with the state of New York so that we can sell books to schools. Well, it's as if I've applied to, you know, build a rocket ship and go to Mars. It's so complex. And so I think we really have to streamline various bureaucratic processes to give small businesses a more level playing field. I know you spoke eloquently and effectively about this in your campaign. But I also want to say this. Small business is very important if you have a small business. But it doesn't exactly come in the top 10 polling issues in an election. So it often gets lost in the congressional discourse on you know, more urgent priorities and issues in Washington.
Of course. And yet I do think this is a matter of folks feeling like government's not on their side rather than having an oppositional role. And I think this is particularly a challenge for us in New York. You know, and so I think more needs to be done. If affordability is a key issue, which indeed it is, the middle class squeeze is driving so much frustration. You're not going to be able to reduce that frustration unless folks feel like, you know, government's there to help genuinely small businesses and not overburden them and treat them like sort of, you know, publicly traded behemoths. Let's focus let's go close to home. This is not a parochial conversation, but Long Island is a very interesting microcosm. It looks more like America than many places people might associate with the politics of the city of New York. You know, interestingly, Donald Trump made his biggest per capita gains in the 2024 election in New Jersey and New York. And that was a surprise to many of us. Without getting into why that is, and we should say, brand new poll out, Donald Trump's numbers are down to 25% among independent voters. Yep. So this is a changing dynamic. But in the 2025 elections, just a month ago, we saw Democrats take the governorships of New Jersey and Virginia. But Bruce Blakeman in Nassau County, the county executive who's looking to run for governor of New York, Republicans remained resurgent in Nassau County. I wonder what the takeaway for you is on that.
Well, I'll tell you, every gray hair on this head was grown when I chaired the BCCC. We realized, and Nancy Pelosi understood, she was the Democratic leader at the time, that we'd won all of the blue districts that we could win. But we were not going to get into the majority unless we began to recruit candidates, field candidates, and win elections in more moderate districts, many of those districts in suburbs. That frustration, I think, was played out long after I left the BCCC and left my seat in Congress. And we've seen it, as you say, on Long Island in the suburbs. The Democrats overperformed in the 25 elections all across the country, not just only with Abigail Spanberger in Virginia and Mikey Sherrill in New Jersey, but down ballot in places, you know, we don't even talk about. But there was a very distinct difference in the suburbs of Long Island where the Republicans overperformed. Now, why is that? It's because suburban voters are inherently, but in their DNA, more moderate. It's because suburban voters want solutions, not ideology. And it's because suburban voters tend to value safety. And so when you talk about defunding the police, and you talk about other programs, that rankles suburban voters. Now, I'm all for police reform, don't get me wrong. But to lead with those and other issues, instead of talking about affordability and safety and quality of life, marginalizes many voters and pushes them in a different direction. So I think what we have learned from Mikey Sherrill and Abigail Spanberger and others is that when you talk about issues that matter to those swing voters who are indispensable to winning purple districts, you win those districts, you win those areas.
Are you concerned, on the other side of the Mike Sher, Abigail Spanberger was Zohran Mamdani's win as mayor of New York. Now he won with just barely over 50% of the vote. Yeah. Against Andrew Cuomo and Curtis Sliwa in a city that's 6-1 Democrat. So I just want to put that in context for people. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as a member of the Democratic Socialists of America, believes deeply and sincerely, apparently, that he does not think the state of Israel is a force for good in the world, yeah, relevant to your book. He is pushing that idea that anti-Zionism is different than anti-Semitism. And I wonder how that hits you. And I want to, before we get into false dualities, I mean, the far right has got a significant anti-Semitism problem, and it goes beyond Nick Fuentes and Tucker Carlson's conversation. But this is something the Democratic Party is confronting. Yeah. How do you think about that challenge and how to address it?
There was a distinct Mamdani effect on Long Island, I believe. Look, every election is a narrative, every single one. And if you were living in Mamdani's media market, you were being told every day that the guy was way too far to the left, was anti-Semitic, anti-Israel, etc. I'll give you an example, John. I don't live in New York City. I live 35 miles east of New York City. But my mailbox on my front lawn almost collapsed under the weight of the anti-Mamdani mail that was filling it, associating Mamdani with every single Democrat running for any office on Long Island. And it worked. You also have, I'll give you another specific example, Congresswoman Laura Gillen in New York's 4th Congressional District. You have a large population of New York City police and firefighters who live in that district. The Republican county executive did very well in that district because of his prosecution of the argument that Mamdani was going to crack down on police, cut police budgets by 20%, et cetera, et cetera. None of that was true, by the way, but they prosecuted the argument. Those are what are called salient issues. You know about issue saliency. Not only are they salient, but they drive voter intensity. And that's why he did so well. And that's why I think we need a counter narrative among Democrats that go back to the issues of affordability, quality of life and safety.
But do you think the increasingly polarizing issue of Israel, how do you recommend Democrats deal with that? Because support for the state of Israel has been bipartisan until recent history.
Yeah.
It's something that matters enormously to many of us, including many of folks on Long Island. And yet you're seeing this polarization and increasing mainstreaming of the idea that you can be anti-Zionist but not anti-Semitic, which history would suggest is a slippery slope.
So, first of all, look, my name is Israel. When I was in Congress, I had about 192% voting record in support of Israel. Unquestionable, still a strong supporter of Israel. But I do believe that as American policymakers who are voting on appropriations and funds and programs and authorizations to support the state of Israel, can have valid differences with various policies within Israel. Now, when it borders on double standards and hypocrisy, there I draw the line. But there are legitimate differences of opinion on how Israel is was prosecuting the war in Gaza. And I don't believe that anybody should be told that they must be silent in expressing those differences in a respectful way without a double standard or any sense of hypocrisy.
Yeah, I think that's the important point to make. One more local issue, but it's really national now. Your former congressional colleague, Lee Zeldin, who represented the 1st District, always presented himself, as many Republicans on Long Island and New York do, as saying, well, I'm a Republican, but I'm very pro-environment. Long Island is, as folks might not know, America's longest island. It is surrounded by water. And the issue of clean water and being strong in the environment is enormously important. It's bipartisan. And yet, he is now Trump's environmental EPA secretary. And the amount of dismantling of anti-science, removing restrictions on pollution, removing references to combating climate change, is so stark. You've known the guy. Did he ever believe it at all? Or is this just what an apparatchik does?
I don't want to get into the heads of Trump's cabinets because I'll have vicarious trauma, I think. So I can't tell you what he believed or didn't believe, but I will say this. Yeah, we were friends. After October 7th, he and I went on the road together, spoke at synagogues together about bipartisan support for Israel. When I served with Lee, he was one of the few Republicans who acknowledged climate change. He worked hard to get funding for the Long Island Sound, not just as an economic development issue, but as an environmental safety issue. And
so what's going on here?
I think he understands he has one boss, and that boss is Donald Trump. And he's a cabinet member who must articulate and execute policies that come down from the president. It's troubling. Just say one other thing. As Trump, we're beginning to see the early dents of a lame duck presidency, right? We're beginning to see Republicans slowly separate themselves from Trump because they realize he may be a liability in 26 in these existential midterms and not necessarily the benefit. Maybe those Republicans will have kind of a second thought process and return to some level of what they used to be.
I do not remotely share that hope or faith.
I understand. I understand.
And look, I'll say this. History's real clear. It's not what you say, it's what you do.
Yeah.
And when you're in a position of power, when you have the microphone, when you've got the ability to execute policy, if it's totally counter to everything you said you once believed, mm-hmm. resign, or we got to assume you never believed it and you're actually, a complete hypocrite because you're doing real damage. Mm-hmm. And that's what's happening. This show is sponsored by GhostBed. Now, the end of the year has a way of catching up on you, right? Long days, short nights, the kind of fatigue that there's just not enough coffee in the world to fix. And if you've been running on empty, better sleep. That might be the smartest reset you can make. And that's where GhostBed comes in. It's a family-run company founded by a team with more than 20 years of mattress-making experience. They've spent literally decades perfecting how to build a bed that helps you rest. So you wake up ready to think clearly, move better, handle everything that's on your plate. Every Ghost Bed mattress comes with premium materials, proven cooling technology, and their exclusive ProCore layer, a targeted support system that reinforces the center of the mattress where your body's the heaviest, keeps your spine aligned, reduces pressure, and helps prevent back pain over time. And Ghost Bed's comfort goes beyond just the mattress. Their pillows and luxury bedding are designed with the same thoughtful approach, made to regulate temperature and give you that finally relaxing feeling at the end of the day. Every mattress comes with a 101-night sleep trial and a 20 to 25-year warranty. Shipping is fast and free, most orders arriving within 2 to 5 days. Better sleep could be yours just a week away. And right now, during GhostBed's Cyber Monday sale, you can get 25% off site-wide for a limited time. Just go to ghostbed.com/fixit. And use the promo code FIXIT at checkout. That's ghostbed.com/fixit, promo code FIXIT, all caps. Upgrade your sleep with the Ghost Bed, the makers of the coolest beds in the world. Some exclusions apply. See site for details. All right. I want to move towards 26 a little even deeper, putting on your former head of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, something you did twice very well, very effectively. The Supreme Court just apparently greenlit the Texas maps. California went through a very different process, a temporary pause, an independent redistricting commission voted on by the people of California. The Supreme Court may come down with a ruling that affects the Voting Rights Act. There's a lot of folks right now who look rightly at Trump's numbers, 25% among independents. It's hard to overstate how bad that is. Mm-hmm. But it's a rigged system of redistricting. Mm-hmm. And so what do you think the map realistically looks like in 26?
I think the Democrats can flip the House if it's a remotely fair fight. It doesn't have to be an entirely fair fight. But look, history wonk to history wonk or political history wonk to another political history wonk. Midterms are always a referendum on the president and his party. Always. There are only several occasions where the president's party actually picked up seats in a midterm election. It happened to George W. Bush. He picked up seats in 2002 because of 9/11. Bill Clinton picked up seats in the House in 1998 because of Newt Gingrich, in a sense that Gingrich had gone too far. FDR picked up seats in his first midterm because people didn't want to change his policies. They thought they were helping. Other than that, the president's party loses seats, an average a loss of 23 seats. So if you look at history and you look at Trump's currently toxic numbers, particularly as you say among independents, the Democrats should flip the House and might even have an outside chance of flipping the Senate. Republicans are doing everything they can to build structure to defy history. It's mid-decade redistricting. It's voter suppression. They'll do everything they can to maintain their majority. So I will say that I do believe the Democrats will flip the House, but it's going to be a razor-thin majority. Can I say one other thing on this, John? I have a piece coming out in the New Republic within the next few days. I'll tell you what I really worry about, what really concerns me. And that is, it's an arcane thing, but I bet the Republicans will try this. It's the use of Article 1, Section 5 to invalidate the midterm elections. Okay. I always thought—
This is really important. Explain this really methodically for folks.
So I got elected to Congress in 2000, and the first thing I did on January 30 after my election was I took my oath, swore in a swearing-in ceremony, and then took my seat. Did that for the next 7 terms. I always thought my seat was bestowed upon me by my district, by my voters. No.
Crazy idea.
It was bestowed upon me by the Speaker of the House. Why? Because Article 1, Section 5 says that it is the Congress that will be the judge of the elections, that the Speaker of the House can decide not to sit a member of Congress based on a variety of issues. It could be the allegation of voter fraud. It could be any number of things. Now, this has been tested in the courts. And the courts generally rule that you can't refuse to seat a member of Congress because the member of Congress was alleged to, even committed a crime. But you can refuse to seat a member of Congress if you believe that the election didn't have an honest outcome. Does anybody think that if the Democrats are 3 to 5 seats ahead in the midterm election, that Donald Trump won't call Speaker Johnson and say, find me 5 Democratic victors who we can say were elected because the system of the election was rigged and refused to seat them? Of course they're going to do that. So I worry a lot about this. Peace is coming out in the New Republic in the next several days, I'm told.
That's an important reality check. And again, I mean, just look at the fact that the President of the United States, for the first time in public, demanded a mid-decade redistricting in Texas and other states in order to hold on to power. I mean, this is a prevent defense version of find me 11,000 more votes.
That's right.
In Georgia.
That's right.
And I share your optimism about the Senate just because I think that Roy Cooper in Maine and Sherrod Brown in Ohio are all incredibly strong candidates. All right, let's talk about 28 and the presidential cycle. First, past his prologue, Biden stepped down. You were very close with Adam Schiff. He believed strongly that was necessary. You believed, as a practical matter, there was no other option than to basically anoint the vice president, Kamala Harris. She had 107 days. It was not a landslide victory that Donald Trump had, but it was a convincing victory, i.e. he won every swing state. Do you, in retrospect, think that a more open process would have benefited Kamala and the Democrats, or no, just as a practical
matter? It's an unknown. I mean, I get it. The alternative would have been we should have had this grand debate and everybody should have been part of the process, and we could have had a series of primaries, maybe, but we didn't. And we don't know how that would have turned out. We don't know whether it would have done more damage than what actually happened. So I can't speculate on what should have happened. I'm more interested in making sure that the Democrats field candidates who have one ability and one ability only to win enough of the 7 battleground states that are necessary to win the Electoral College.
Yeah. So let's talk about who you think at this stage. I'm not asking you who you're endorsing or supporting, but just, name three candidates, including one outside the box, who you think could accomplish that mission knowing what we know now. Who's got the profile and the chops, understanding that not a single primary has happened, and that itself is a clarifying contest.
Well, I'm literally after this on my way to get on a plane to join a bunch of those candidates in Phoenix, Arizona, to have lunch and dinner with them, to kind of hear what they have to say. So invite me back on after this event, and I can tell you what I think. But look, first of all, full disclosure, I was mentored in House Democratic politics by Rahm Emanuel. I am super close to him. Talk to him frequently. This is a guy who knows how to win. This is a guy who articulates the need to rebuild, reignite the American dream. This is a guy who understands why voters in Scranton, Pennsylvania, and Kenosha, Wisconsin, and Maricopa, Arizona, didn't support Democrats and what it takes to bring them back. So he's appealing. Cory Booker, I actually think, could be quite appealing.
Could be a great Senate Majority Leader at some point in the future.
Yes, yes. For me, it's not about the personality. It's about what do you need to be able to literally win enough of those battleground states? And there are seven of them. Who's going to be able to win those states and bring us a presidency and rebuild a durable majority of Democrats in the Congress?
That is the assignment. That is, you know, until we can broaden the base and not simply focus on policy agendas driven by safe Democratic seats, you're not going to be able to build it. But personality matters, talent matters, message matters. But you also got to prove that, you know, I think Democrats sometimes have gotten in a trap of waiting for Republicans to overreach and then will benefit by proxy. But if you can't make a difference, a meaningful difference in people's lives in that time, you're going to lose the plot.
Yeah, I mean, one other thing on this, John, I'm curious in your views, you know, there's some geographic benefits to a Josh Shapiro in Pennsylvania, who's showed us how you win Western Pennsylvania, or Mark Kelly in Arizona, who's shown us how you win Pima County, Arizona.
So, Kelly and Gallego, I think they've got a lot. You know, there are X factors, obviously, with charisma, communication, but unbelievable story for Mark Kelly. Shapiro in Pennsylvania, I'll just say this. If you've got a Democratic governor of Pennsylvania has a 62% approval rating in a swing state, pay attention.
Exactly.
I mean, it's money. Don't overthink that. Don't overthink it.
Right.
Yeah. And I will say, I mean, look, I think there are a lot of talented folks. Pete Buttigieg is very talented. I think Wes Moore is incredibly compelling. Mm-hmm. I think Democrats need to put forward people who've served the military at some place in the ticket. You know, I understand that Admiral McRaven is not wanting to get in the ring, but I think, you know, he's an American hero. And I think we need something different now, not speaking as Democrats, but as Americans, because we are so dangerously polarized now that the authoritarian competitors around the world are successfully stoking our divisions. And we need to change the paradigm to get the upper hand. I want to end with just some foreign policy conversations. You were on the Armed Services Committee. You're on appropriations. So you may have other insights into that before we go to a macro fix it. But there are a lot of noises that that the United States military may not just be targeting drug runners with extrajudicial killings, but looking at regime change in Venezuela. Now, I will say from my perspective that the amount of damage that's been done in Venezuela by the Chavez-Maduro regime is stark. It's horrific. But when you get into regime change, it's history again rears its head. Very difficult to win the peace. And if you don't win the peace, you don't win the war. So what do you think about this situation we're at right now that you know, could turn hot soon?
It's dangerous for us. It's dangerous for our allies, dangerous for our troops. John, I was on the Armed Services Committee. Defense, national security was kind of my policy wheelhouse. Been to Iraq and Afghanistan well over 20 times. Spent a good part of my time in Congress sitting with our heroes, military, in the military, in remote operating bases in Afghanistan. What is vital to their safety and security is that our allies and our adversaries regard us as credible, strong, consistent in our policy. And right now, we are not credible, and we are operating recklessly around the world. We are turning our backs on places like Ukraine, advocating a peace plan that could have been your AI probably wrote it for Putin, in my view.
Let's talk about the reporting around this. Steve Witkoff met with a Russian envoy of Putin in Miami, and it appears that that it was translated from the Russian that was put forward by the United States, which is a scandal that in 50 years someone else should write a novel about. It's insane.
So we are assassinating sailors on boats, which, you know, and I use that word advisedly. No due process. We are operating against the laws of war. One thing that I learned from our war fighters is what we do to them, they can do to us. And if we are engaging in abnormal behavior, that means our adversaries can engage in abnormal behavior back to us. And fundamentally, we have an obligation not just to protect and support the Constitution, but to protect and support the warfighters. And that is not happening right now. We are actually elevating risk.
And not only that, I'll add that the focus on ICE raids right now, at least regionally in New York and on Long Island, is taking people, members of the FBI and other groups off Joint Terrorism Task Force and other attacks, which is a very, very dangerous game to play. All right. I want to close on this. You had an extraordinary career in Congress. You remain really one of the leaders of the Democratic Party, as well as a small bookstore owner and author. If you could pass three pieces of legislation that you think would make a meaningful trajectory difference, not for the Democratic Party, but for the United States, what would they be?
Could I give you two?
Sure.
These are the two things that I think would have the most impact on right-sizing American political discourse. One is redistricting reform. You said it earlier. We have a stacked deck. Districts should not be drawn in order to protect incumbents and pull those incumbents further to the far left or far right. Districts should be drawn just based on the number of people that members of Congress represent. I would support a national commission that would actually help draw districts, not influenced by partisan gain, and create more districts where compromise and bipartisanship are a value, not something to be used against a member. And then the second thing I would do is pass fundamental reform of campaign finance, John. You know, I left Congress, I did a piece in the New York Times called Confessions of a Congressman, where I quantified the number of hours that I spent raising money, the number of soggy egg rolls and hot dogs that I ate at fundraisers, the number of squishy eggs that I had at the local restaurant on Capitol Hill, begging people for PAC donations. It is also rigging the system against the American people and the middle class. Those two things, campaign finance reform, fundamental campaign finance reform, and prohibitions against partisan redistricting, I think will go a long way to bringing America back to where it needs to be.
From a voice of experience from one who's been there, Steve Israel, former congressman, thanks, pal, author of the great new book. And go out and buy this. A great read over the holidays. Get it for your folks. It really is. It's fun. It's fast. It's phenomenal. And it's historic. The Einstein Conspiracy. Steve, thanks for joining us on How to Fix.
Thank you, John. Appreciate you.
All right. Be well.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No